Hello, my name is Stephen Bigelow, features writer with TechTarget Storage Media Group, and I'm speaking with Greg Schultz, founder and senior analyst with the Storage.io Group in Stillwater, Minnesota. Greg is also author of the book Resilient Storage Networks, Designing Scalable, Flexible Data Infrastructures. Greg, thanks so much for joining us today to discuss SAN technology.
Great, Steve. My pleasure.
Greg, there are lots of questions surrounding SAN technology, deployment, and operation. So let's go through some of the most frequent questions that you encounter. And I think the first question really speaks to SAN applicability. Is a small to medium-sized business environment too small for a SAN?
Steve, most any size business could benefit from a SAN of some shape or form. Now, we've got to talk for a moment about what does that mean. Does that mean a large fiber channel-based SAN, or does that mean an iSCSI-based SAN? So the real gist there is that most any business can benefit from, probably a better term is, some form of network storage, whether it's network-attached storage, iSCSI-based storage, or even fiber channel-based storage. But it's really about scaling the right solution, the right technology to that particular environment. Now, certainly an environment with one or two servers, a storage network might be overkill. But that could also be a nice fit for, that might be a nice environment for using network-attached storage or NAS. As you start to scale up, as you have more servers, you've got more opportunity for shared storage, for consolidated management. That's where an iSCSI type SAN could come into play. As you grow up, even more servers, more numbers, or more performance type requirements, that's where a small fiber channel type SAN could come into play. So I would say that most any environment could benefit from some form of detached, network attached, whether it's NAS or SAN, iSCSI, or fiber channel-based shared storage.
So really it's all about matching the technology to your own particular needs.
Yeah, absolutely, Steve. And if I could build on that one for a moment, is a tip, a comment is don't get too hung up on the wire, or on the cabling, I should say. In other words, iSCSI versus fiber channel versus even NAS for that matter. Focus on the storage, focus on the storage management capabilities. In other words, what I mean by that, Steve, is look at the storage solution, the storage system, and its overall feature capabilities. In other words, snapshot capabilities for point-in-time copies to support backup, replication, local and remote mirroring functionality, levels of RAID, the ability to dynamically add storage, the ability to upgrade seamlessly without disruption. In other words, what will the storage system do for that particular environment? How does it scale? What are the economics of it? And then how can you attach to it? And what is the most effective means of attaching for your particular environment? And you might find that if you have one or two servers, it might be NAS, but it might also be a point-to-point serial-attached SCSI SAS or iSCSI or fiber channel. So don't get too hung up on the wiring, on the cabling. It is important. Focus more on that functionality. It's like looking and going to buy an appliance and picking out your extension cord first and then going and looking for your appliance. Both are important, but keep things in relative perspective, Steve.
That's a great insight, Greg. That's terrific. And in terms of technologies, another general question that we see quite a bit is, what is the difference between InfiniBand, SAS, and iSCSI, and where does each technology fit in the grand scheme of things?
You know, Steve, that's an interesting question, and from the fact that SAS, or serial-attached SCSI, is something that we're hearing more and more about these days. But let's look at them in their ordering. InfiniBand is an interface, just like fiber channel, just like Ethernet. And as an interface, it carries different protocols. Okay, an example of a protocol is the SCSI command set that can run on InfiniBand. The SCSI command set runs on top of fiber channel and other mechanisms. iSCSI is an implementation of the SCSI command set running on IP, running on Ethernet. So where SAS fits on this is, SAS is an interface for attaching disk drives to servers, storage arrays to servers, also to attach disk drives within storage arrays. So let's put all this in perspective. could have a server that has an InfiniBand host channel adapter, known as an HCA, that attaches to an InfiniBand array. On top of that InfiniBand connection, could be running SCSI, could be running iSCSI or some other protocol, IP or something else. They could then be turned talking to an array that has SAS disk drives attached to it. So for a small environment, for a small server, you might use serial attached SCSI to attach a local SCSI drive or a local serial attached SCSI drive, such as a blade server, a small 1U type rack mount server. Or you might have serial attached SCSI in an array coexisting with SATA type drives. Or you might have network type storage where you're using iSCSI to access an array that has SAS disk drives in it.
So you see these technologies really as working together, as complementary.
Oh, absolutely. They of course, they will be positioned against each other. You know, it's a lot like, Steve, you'll hear InfiniBand versus iSCSI, which is like Fibre Channel versus iSCSI. They're apples to apples. I mean, they're apples to oranges, because InfiniBand's an interface. It should be compared to Fibre Channel. Fibre Channel should be compared to Ethernet. Those are your interfaces. Then compare your protocols. In other words, iSCSI versus SCSI on Fibre Channel or SCSI on InfiniBand or another upper-level type protocol. Compare apples to apples. However, as we described here, InfiniBand, SAS, iSCSI are very much very complementary. It's a matter of, are you going to run iSCSI on InfiniBand or are you going to run it on Ethernet?
Excellent. And Greg, another general question to do with SANs is, what is the difference between SAN routing, channel extension, and virtualization?
So when we talk about SAN routing, there's a couple different things that come to mind. Some see SAN routing as just segmentation. Some see it as protocol conversion. Some see it as distance enablement. SAN routing really embraces all of those and even more functionality. So let's take a look at each of those real quickly. So SAN segmentation is about being able to separate logically different fabrics. In other words, I could connect multiple fiber channel fabrics together, yet have them logically isolated. In other words, maintain their own autonomy, maintain their own separate namespaces, not have to worry about management traffic going across the different fabrics, keeping them isolated, just like you would segment a LAN or a regular network by keeping them segmented. The other form of routing is that of distance. In other words, what's been traditionally known as channel extension from the mainframe type world coming into the open systems world. So, example, using storage over IP, for example, fiber channel over IP, FCIP, or IFCP, or other technologies mapping to enable storage to be moved over long distances for remote mirroring, remote replication, remote copy, remote backups, things like that, as well as remote access. The other is protocol conversion. And protocol conversion, a classic example would be fiber channel to iSCSI or iSCSI to fiber channel conversion, being able to map a protocol across different interfaces and allow it to be bridged or to be routed across different networks. So consequently, you'll hear the term router, you'll hear the term gateway, bridge, and maybe other various vendor-defined type terms, but they're really all getting back to that basic function of routing, either routing traffic between network segments, routing protocols across different interfaces, or routing data over long distances across the same or different networks.
And with all of that information about SAN routing, Greg, can you define where channel extension and virtualization fit a little bit more in that that continuum?
Yeah, that's a great way to build onto it. So that storage over distance piece, Steve, that's where the channel extension would come in. Channel extension, for those coming from the mainframe world, you would latch onto that term SAN extension, maybe storage over distance. So for example, being able to take fiber channel and span long, long distances, more than 100 kilometers, for example, being able to map fiber channel onto IP or even fiber channel directly onto SONET to span distances for those remote mirroring replications. The other capability is that of virtualization. And that virtualization could mean different things. It could mean volume management, LUN pooling, LUN management, mirroring, replication. It could also mean snapshots, point-time copies, transparent data migration, and other functionalities that would normally be handled either in a volume manager or within a storage system, storage array itself. So what you have, Steve, and this can sometimes be a confusing aspect of things, is that different vendors' products can do different things. So, for example, the Brocade multi-protocol router, I think it's the EP7420, also known as MPR, the multi-protocol router, the product they acquired via Rhapsody, if that helps put it in perspective, can do different things. It can function as a protocol conversion, iSCSI to fiber channel. It can do other. It can also host storage virtualization applications. For example, it's one of the platforms for EMC and Vista, as well as the Fujitsu virtualization platform. So it's a platform like the Cisco storage services blade. Those types of technologies, it's a platform that can do different things. It's how it's configured. It's what software you run on it. And that begs the question, or probably the response, which is, when a vendor talks to you that they have a blade, a module, a router, your first question should be, okay, what software, what functionality can you run on that? Because by itself, it's just a piece of hardware. It needs software. Likewise, that software needs a home to run, which would be that hardware platform.
Well, Greg, one other addition to that question. Do you see SAN routing capability, channel extension, and virtualization support as all existing on the same product? Or is that are those really three different arenas of functions that don't necessarily exist in the same product?
Good question, Steve. And there are some solutions that essentially specialize. For example, there's vendors like QLogic, SANRAD, and others that make specific appliances, specific routers, specific gateways, bridges, devices that do just protocol conversion. Or protocol conversion with some level of volume management. Okay? And where those typically play, Steve, is you want to keep your costs down, you want to keep your deployment costs down, you want the ability to integrate to do a particular functionality without the cost or the complexity. So that's where you tend to see purpose-built, whether it be a purpose-built protocol conversion type device or, for example, a purpose-built SAN extension device like those from McData that they acquired via their Nishan and CNT acquisitions that are purpose-built channel extenders for spanning distances. Then you also have the multi-protocol or the multi-function type devices like the Cisco and the Brocade modules that can do multiple different things depending on how they're programmed, configured, and deployed. So it really varies by what the vendor has as an offering, and you'll find different vendors now will offer, Steve, tiers of functionality. In other words, you can buy a solution, a blade, a module, if you would, that can do a lot of different things depending on how you configure it, or a purpose-built, target-specific type device, depending on what your particular needs are. Which is great because now, like as part of tiered storage, you can leverage the notion of tiered access, tiered connectivity, apply the right technology to the task at hand without having to have more than what you need in terms of functionality, but also helps bring cost in line to your particular task that you're doing.
Terrific. And, Greg, I know that distance is playing an increasingly important role in SAN deployments in terms of replication, redundancy, disaster recovery, and whatnot. I guess the next question for us should be, how far apart can sand locations be?
You know, how far they can be and need to be probably are two different type questions. Sand storage, for that matter, can be very, very, very far apart. I mean, thousands of kilometers, thousands of miles apart. In other words, you can separate by oceans, those sorts of distance, by large continents, land masses. The question comes down to is what are your tolerances for latency? Let me put this in perspective. If you're doing remote mirroring, if you're running synchronous, in other words, real time, no delay, no loss of data, you're striving for a recovery time objective or an RTO and a recovery point objective, RPO, of say zero or near zero, you'd be wanting to run synchronous. Well, running in synchronous type mode, you're going to want to keep your distances relatively short, and that's going to be determined by the speed, the type of the network. It is possible. There are vendors that advertise and tout and promote and claim to be able to run, say, 300 kilometers in synchronous type mode. Well, the question I'd be raising right off the bat is, what is your tolerance? What is your exposure with your RTO, RPO requirements and needs to that latency? Because you will have some latency. Okay. Now, if we switch to a different mode of thinking, asynchronous, in other words, time delay, okay, time delay where there is the possibility that some data could be exposed. I don't have to be real-time or near real-time. I could be maybe a couple seconds, a couple minutes, maybe even an hour delayed. Okay, when we go into asynchronous type mode, Steve, now that's where we can span hundreds to thousands of kilometers in distances. Okay, distance, latency is the enemy when it comes to real-time synchronous type processing. Okay, and usually the most common enemy of latency is distance. Okay, the longer you go distance, whether you're on fiber optics or whatever the medium is, distance, latency work against each other. Okay, putting that into perspective, latency can exist inside a data center, inside a campus, inside a metro area, even where you have very, very fast, dedicated high-speed networks. If there is a network bottleneck, if there's any network congestion, anything that causes delays, delays are latency, add to latency, and those are the enemies of distance. Okay? So, how far can you go? Theoretically, you could go around the globe, but you're dealing with latency. So, the tip here, Steve, is when you're looking at long distances, don't look just at bandwidth. Okay? In other words, when vendors tell you that they can maintain a level of bandwidth at a particular distance, look at that, but also ask, what is the effective latency? What is the effective utilization? What is it that you're actually going to get? What is that quality of service, that level of service, and what is the delay? And what is your application sensitivity to that delay, to that latency?
Excellent. That's some great advice, Greg. Greg, how does IP storage differ from iSCSI, NAS, and Fiber Channel? I know there's a lot of interest in IP storage, and can you give us a sense of how those all compare?
Yeah, Steve, let's take a look at that. Some refer to IP storage as being any type of storage, storage functionality, storage capability, or accessing storage involving TCP/IP. For example, iSCSI, IFCP, FCIP, NAS, or even content addressable storage or CAS, object-based storage accessed via IP. Others will refer to IP storage as some subset. So, for example, the iSCSI folks may view IP storage as only being iSCSI, or others may view IP storage as being only NAS, or it depends on your focus, the context that you're looking at it from. But what does it really put into perspective is that the difference between IP storage and, say, for example, Fiber Channel is, again, apples to oranges. Are you comparing the protocols, the functionality, the applications, or are you comparing the interface? In other words, fiber channel versus Ethernet, or block versus file, iSCSI block, fiber channel, block-based versus network attached story, NFS SIFS, file-based access. But generically, IP storage looks at any type of storage functionality that is leveraging TCP/IP as a network transport. So in other words, being able to use TCP/IP-based network running on some physical network, for example, Ethernet or InfiniBand, to perform storage functions. And those storage functions could be accessing storage, using iSCSI to access storage, using NAS as a means for accessing and sharing storage and data, using IFCP or FCIP to span long distances with fiber channel, and so forth.
So these are really separate ideas, but there's potentially some overlap between them?
Absolutely. They can be very complementary. For example, fiber channel over IP, FCIP, or IFCP for spanning distances is very complementary to enable a fiber channel-based or a FICON-based storage network to span long distances for business continuance, data migration, compliance, for whatever your needs happen to be. So that's where they can work very complementary. But we also see the competitive aspect, the positioning of the fiber channel camp, the fiber channel community, looking to want to take on the IP community. And it's usually more the opposite, where you see IP vendors wanting to do more, wanting to bite into the fiber channel world. And what's kind of taking place right now is a little bit of the different technologies finding their real relative space, their domains, if you would. In other words, fiber channel in the enterprise, iSCSI in the SMB, SME, or in the branch office in the distributed enterprise, and then NAS kind of fitting between those. Over time, however, we will see the reemergence of storage interface wars. In other words, iSCSI conquering the world, or fiber channel survival, or whatever it happens to be. Every few years, Steve, we see a reemergence of the storage wars, the storage interface wars pop up. And they usually coincide with some new interface or some new initiative or some new development taking place.
Interesting. And who do you think would win that kind of a conflict?
You know, right now, I think it's still somewhat status quo. In other words, if we look at, we put hype aside. In other words, hype had fiber channel dead 6 years ago. Hype has fiber channel dead right now. Hype had iSCSI running the world several years ago. Hype had InfiniBand replacing PC High, okay? But what's the reality? PCI Express is now becoming more and more prevalent. iSCSI is no longer hype, it is reality. If we look at in the mid-range, down into the lower end of the enterprise or in branch offices of enterprise, iSCSI is a reality. NAS is a reality from all the way down to the SOHO up into the enterprise. Now, fiber channel, it's up in the enterprise. It has come down into the SMB space, but I don't see fiber channel going down very, very low into the SMB. It'll be there. It'll be there as a connectivity. Likewise, it'll be a while before we see NAS go up to the very top of the enterprise pyramid or storage stack, but it's moving up. Over time, I think we will see iSCSI move further up into the stack as well as down into the stack as the technology becomes more mature, as the costs come into line, as things like 10 gig Ethernet and other enabling technologies come about, we will see more adoption. However, it's going to take time for that. In other words, there's still plenty of life left in fiber channel. iSCSI has a very bright future, and NAS, I think, is a diamond in the rough that really has a lot of upside.
Excellent. Greg, let me ask a question regarding the connectivity of BitRadio. What's the difference between Sonnet, SDH, DWDM, and OCX? Why not just use TCP?
That's a good question, Steve. And the reason I think it's a good question is we live in a virtual world today, okay? We live in a virtual world where most of us have in our homes, if we don't, we should have it fairly soon, some form of network access. We have the internet, and the internet is really a virtual network. When we have internet connection, what do we have? We have some form or derivative of TCP/IP connection, and it probably is manifesting itself into the home as some form of Ethernet-based derivative. Now, how does that get to your home? That's that virtual network behind the scenes. Okay, to get to your home, you're probably running something like an ADSL, an asynchronous digital subscriber line, or maybe a dial-up, or maybe you have some other sort of mechanism. There's that network cloud. That's where technologies like Sonnet, Synchronous Optical Network, and SDH, the Synchronous Digital Hierarchy for our friends over in Europe and other parts of the world, and other technologies like wave division multiplexing, WDM, dense wave division multiplexing, DWDM, coarse wave division multiplexing, CWDM, as well as optical carrier networks, OCXs, and other technologies exist. So again, why not just use TCP? Well, the reality is you probably are, but TCP is just a protocol that has to run on some sort of network transport. Sonnet is a network transport. Sonnet is a network transport that carries TCP-based traffic. Ethernet is an interface. Fiber Channel is an interface. InfiniBand is an interface. They run on a network. The networks that are in that generic cloud that we talked a moment ago about, Steve, telephone carrier-based networks have been built on Sonnet-based networks that are based on usually optical-type networks for many, many years, particularly for spanning distances. So let's break this down real quickly. At the lowest level, optical cabling, maybe copper. That copper cabling then supports some network. For example, a Sonnet network, or maybe Fiber Channel, Ethernet, InfiniBand mapped directly onto it. You can increase your bandwidth using that multiplexing, wave division, dense wave division, coarse wave division. You can also, on a Sonnet network, allocate sub-bandwidth speeds into what are called optical carrier networks, or OC3s, OC12s, OC48s, different subdivisions. And those, in turn, can be carrying different traffic. So, why not just use TCP? From an upper level, from a virtual standpoint, yeah, that TCP/IP, that is your virtual network. But there's that physical network, what's inside that cloud that you want to, maybe you don't want to be aware of, but that's where those things fit into the picture. If I could, if you're interested and want to learn more about where these technologies fit, what's inside that cloud, take a look at chapters 5 and 6 in my book, Resilient Storage Network. In other words, the chapters on optical essentials as well as metro and wide area storage networking to learn more about where these technologies are, where they fit, how they complement and work with each other, but also to gain a little bit more insight, Steve, on what's inside that cloud so that when you are shopping for network bandwidth, when you're shopping for bandwidth services, you can be a more informed buyer to look for better bargains, look for options and things like that.
Greg, let me move along to a couple of questions about switches and switches on the SAN. How are switches changing the way SANs are designed and managed?
Steve, for the most part, you have more options today. You have more flexibility. You have more tools in your toolbox, so to speak, to work with, and in some cases, even better interoperability. However, having said that, there's always room for improvement when it comes to interoperability. There are also more granularities in terms of device options, how you can configure them to meet different needs versus in the past. You also have, as part of that granularity, larger type devices. In other words, you have in the past where you may have had to network together to create a fabric of multiple switches interconnected together to scale. Now you've got larger port count switches, larger port count type directors. And they in turn can support multiple protocols. They can support specialized blades to support protocol conversion, SCSI to fiber channel, to support 1 gig, 2 gig, 4 gig coexistence, load balancing, optimization, virtualization, a lot of different functionalities. So you can simplify things. You can also configure to avoid single points of failures, to avoid bottlenecks. But I think one of the interesting ones is that you have more options now, whether you're a blade server, you've got blade switches, or you're looking to streamline or consolidate multiple SANs with large port count switches and directors, with partitioning, segmentations. We're seeing tiered access with the switches. In other words, the switches are supporting tiered access, align the right technology to the right need, whether it's 4 gig fiber channel or iSCSI, being able to use that switch as a connectivity center to support your different access type needs. The other piece is maturing. The technology that we're seeing now today is much more mature, much more robust than we've seen in the past.
And I guess the next question, Greg, really refers to switch selection. What type of switch should you choose for a SAN design? Should it be a director class switch, or should it be some other class of switch?
So deciding between a director and a switch, first discussion should be, what are your needs, what are your requirements, what are you looking to do? Where things have become blurred is that there are large switches. Okay. It used to be, what was the difference between a switch and a director? Well, some would say just simply the number of ports. Others would say the number of ports, the performance, the number of protocols supported, the architecture. How modular was it? Could you swap blades in and out? How scalable was it? Things like that. That's become very blurred today because we have switches that are, say, 64 ports. And are somewhat modular. They've got some levels of redundancy, and they can support multiple protocols. So that line is blurring. I take a step back and say, what are your requirements? What protocols do you need to support? Do you need to support all fiber channel or all FICON, or is it fiber channel and FICON? What speeds do you need to support? Is it 1 gig, 2 gig, 4 gig? Do you need the ability to oversubscribe ports? So for example, you've got multiple slower servers that you want to aggregate and use a very expensive, high-performance 4-gig port on your storage device. So to maximize that, you want to aggregate and consolidate to fan in all these slower server ports, what would be in the past referred to as oversubscribing, onto that particular storage port. And you want to do that via the switch itself. Do you want to support segmentation, the ability to partition, isolate workloads, isolate traffic? What are your distance requirements? Do you need to support iSCSI? How many ports do you need today? How many in the future? What are your resiliency type requirements? So in other words, take a look at those attributes. Then I would look at what the vendors are offering and which one of those products that they have fit those requirements. And then, is it a director or is it a switch? Okay. Does it have dual power, you know, redundant power, redundant cooling, hot swap, the ability to upgrade firmware as well as activate it online and while in use, if those are your requirements? So I wouldn't start with director versus switch. I would look at, based on your requirements, whatever those requirements happen to be, what are the nice-to-have, what are the need-to-haves, then line up and go through the different vendors' product offerings and see what meets those needs, keeping in mind future expansion, growth, and things like that.
And Greg, just to build on the discussion a little bit, can you highlight for us the role of intelligence in directors and other types of switches?
Yeah, that's a good point, Steve, is we hear about intelligent switches, virtualization switches, switch virtualization, virtual switches, things like that. And if we take that in the context of intelligent switches being able to support and perform storage virtualization type functionality, again, separate the discussion from switches and directors, because right now today, on the director type products, it would require a blade to be able to do that. It's a specialized blade. In fact, you're more likely to see that functionality deployed on a blade put into a small enclosure, or what some might refer to as an appliance. So where does this tie back to directors is, there is no one-to-one association that storage intelligence, intelligent switches have to be a director, or that a director has to be used to implement that functionality. There are some implementations, for example, running on virtualization type functionality, running on a blade that might be in a large director or a large switch. The reality is that most of the deployments leveraging these intelligent router blades, functionality type blades, have been in smaller scale packages. In other words, like in couple U versus the very large. That probably will change moving forward as the next generation of blades come out, functionality enhances, more software, things like that. Having said that, there have been on the market products that have been dedicated towards being quote-unquote intelligent switches, or geared towards being just for that sort of functionality. In other words, more emphasis on the virtualization, on the intelligence, on the software versus on the switching. Those, for the most part, have gone to the wayside except for purpose-built SAN appliances that still do exist in the marketplace.
Well, the next few questions have to do with virtualization. And the first part of that is, what really has been the impact of storage virtualization on SAN deployments?
I have to think on that one for a minute, Steve, because I haven't really seen a big impact, in other words, virtualization really driving SAN deployments. There have been some cases, in other words, if you look at IBM with their SAN volume controller, known as SVC, I think IBM estimates probably what, around 2,000, maybe 2,100 plus and growing installs. And those installs do involve some SAN of some type. What's not clear is, was a SAN put in to support those SVC installs, or did a SAN exist and SVC came in to complement, augment, facilitate, address a particular issue. So, has there been a big drive, a big push of virtualization to drive SAN adoption? I don't think so. I don't believe so yet, Steve. It's been more of a complementary type technology. In other words, most of the SAN adoptions have not been for intelligent storage, virtualization, and a lot of the hype of the almost science fiction type reading of the 90s. Most of the adoption has been go for the low-lying fruit, which is simplify the connectivity, take that first step, that first building block step of improving the connectivity, improve basic storage sharing to set the stage for that next step, which could be leveraging virtualization, it could be implementing NAS, network attached storage, leveraging SAN underlying type storage from a connectivity. I mean, let's put it in perspective. SAN is about connectivity, not about intelligence per se. So that building block is, we're to the point now where we need to start adding some different layers to build out some of those blue sky cloudware type visions to move to that next step.
So virtualization has brought some benefits to the SAN, but it's not driving the SAN forward.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, moving forward, the two almost need to be driven, they coexisting, but it's like virtualization. Why do you want to put virtualization in unless there's a clear-cut benefit to you and to address a particular pain point. Okay? In other words, will the solution, will virtualization work for you, or will you end up working for it? If you have to work for it, if you have to work for the virtualization to keep it working, to keep it operating how you want it to do, I'd let it incubate a little bit longer. However, if you can bring virtualization technology in to address particular pain points, and if it can start solving problems for you, that it's not a management burden for you, you may have yourself a winner. And that SAN connectivity, again, they're complementary. It goes back to apples to oranges type comparisons. The SAN, that's just more connectivity, your network interfaces, your protocols and things like that, as opposed to that next step I think that we're getting closer to, which is leveraging different types of virtualization, whether it's virtual tape, virtual networks, virtual switches, virtual storage, storage virtualization, I/O virtualization, things like that. Those are all part of those building blocks that are starting to come into place that over time we just keep piecing together to meet that end objective. And that's probably the most important is, what is your objective? What are you trying to get to? How can these different technologies help you?
We hear virtualization tossed around so often, there's some confusion out there. Can you explain to us the difference between virtualization switches and virtual SANs?
Yeah, see, that's one of the challenges. With a word like virtual, I mean, it means virtual anything, and it's used so loosely, it's thrown around so much that to some people, you hear the word virtual, they're going to think virtual server, or that virtual means volume management, or it means virtual tape, or a virtual switch. So let's zero in on a couple of things. What is a virtual switch? Well, some switches, some of the large port count director type devices, have the ability to take some number of their ports and logically isolate them from each other and effectively create multiple switches, each representing either as a part of different fabrics or part of the same fabric, but functioning as a separate switch domain with its own name server, its own identity, its own capabilities. Similar to how you could partition or virtualize a server that it's one physical server, but running multiple virtual machines in a VMware-type environment, or how you could partition a storage system to appear as different virtual storage machines. So in a switch, you could partition a switch to isolate workload, isolate traffic, isolate ports from each other. The other idea is a virtual SAN. The idea being that I could create different sub-networks, different fabrics that are physically interconnected but logically isolated, similar to a network virtual LAN, where the LANs are physically connected but virtually isolated. The idea being is keep local traffic local. In other words, if I've got traffic going around my LAN or around my SAN, I don't need it going out over the network and running around out in somebody else's SAN segment. So it's there for isolation, segmentation, keeping workload traffic, management traffic, configuration traffic, error notification, things like that, keeping that isolated from each other, but also still allowing information that needs to go from one network to the other to be able to flow. So SAN, a virtual switch, is the ability to create multiple virtual switches out of a physical switch, just like creating virtual machines on a server with like a VMware, a Virtual Iron, or a Zen Microsoft type technology. A virtual fabric would be a fabric that might be physically interconnected with another network or with another SAN, but logically isolated.
Terrific. And Greg, the next question really has to do with bandwidth and utilization. Why should someone go to a 4 gigabit fiber channel infrastructure if they're not fully utilizing their 1 gigabit or 2 gigabit SAN bandwidth now?
Well, depending based upon your environment needs, your requirements, there may not be a compelling argument at this point to switch to 4 gig. However, I'm sure the 4 gig fiber channel vendors can come up with some reasons why you should. For example, people get way too hung up. I think a lot of the vendors have gotten way too hung up focused on the bandwidth characteristic of fiber channel. And not just fiber channel, Steve. We always tend to hear about bandwidth, 10 gig bandwidth, 4 gig bandwidth, bandwidth in general. But let's take a look at some things. For example, many common business applications do require some level of bandwidth. However, they're also very time sensitive, response time, latency, and they typically tend to do more smaller IOs. If you're doing lots of small IOs, Steve, you're not going to see a lot of large bandwidth, but you're going to see a lot of activity. Likewise, if I'm doing video streaming, seismic telemetry information, large sequential type functions, those typically aren't response time sensitive. They are sensitive to streaming the data in large bandwidth type environments. So what does this mean? In the normal commercial mainstream type environment, you may not be using all of your existing 1 gig, 2 gig bandwidth, but how many IO operations per second are you putting out on that network? What is your response time? So what this comes back to, and I think the opportunity for the storage vendors, the switch vendors, the adapter vendors, is to make noise and educate people that it's not just about that 4 gig bandwidth. It's about latency, that you could double, go from 2 to 4 gig, and so what if you don't need the bandwidth? If you could cut your response time in half, if you could lower your latency by going to that faster network, now all of a sudden you can make that database transaction run faster. You can make that website, that transaction turnaround. If you have latency-dependent applications, 4 gig might be for you. If you have the need to aggregate, I've got multiple slower servers, maybe each running at 1 gig, but I'm going to bring in a 4 gig fiber channel based storage system. Those ports, I want to optimize their use. I want to run those at full utilization. So let's use a device that, a switch, that I can fan in all these slower 1 gig server ports, or maybe even bring in some iSCSI ports, Steve. Aggregate that, fan in, funnel all that aggregated bandwidth, and then deliver that to a 4 gig port. Okay, that's where we come back to the notion of tiered storage involves tiered access. Aggregate all those ports, and all of a sudden, I have a need for 4 gig. Put that now, deliver that to that 4 gig storage port, or reversely, use that 4 gig port to retrieve information to serve all that. So it's not all about bandwidth. It's about latency, about response time, about the number of IO operations per second. And for the vendors who are hung up on bandwidth, you're missing a golden opportunity to go out and prospect for ports to attach to aggregate, to consolidate, as well as to look to improve latency.
And Greg, you had spoken a little bit earlier about subscribing, oversubscribing, undersubscribing. What guidelines should our listeners use for oversubscribing or undersubscribing their ports?
Steve, oversubscription has been a contentious topic. It's not as bad as it used to be, but several years ago, I mean, it was a very contentious topic, particularly amongst vendors and also from different schools of thought, okay? Oversubscription versus undersubscription, over-engineered versus under-engineered. And I'm sure we can still generate some interesting responses and fan mail. But let's put some things in perspective is that in the old school, back in the mainframe, it was one-to-one in some instances. In other words, there are some people that believe that you always dedicate a port to a port, one-to-one, no oversubscription. The reality is that we live in an oversubscribed world. Okay? The idea, the notion of an engineered network, engineered design, in other words, let's take a look at what is the bandwidth. We've talked about, for example, 4 gig fiber channel and about how a particular server may not be able to push 4 gig. However, if we aggregate the bandwidth, or if we aggregate the I/O operations and their resulting performance requirements across multiple servers and how they aggregate and converge at a storage port, conventional wisdom would say, well, geez, that's going to lead to oversubscription. Well, it might, but it might not. What we have to look at is, what is the activity? What is the profile? What is the activity in terms of the I/O operations, the response time, the queuing delays, the bandwidth, the characteristics of the servers, of the workloads, the applications? What workload, what burden are they putting on that network? How can that network satisfy those servers, but also keep the data flowing? Okay. Are there rules of thumb of how many servers or what level can you oversubscribe to? There's a lot of different ones floating around out there, but it comes back to just align, make sure that a server has the bandwidth it needs, the I/O capability it needs to meet a particular level of service. If you have an application, a server, that requires guaranteed performance, it has to be the best performance capability to meet peak demand, surge demand, whatever it happens to be. Something like that, I'd probably just bite the bullet and configure it. Dedicate a port to it, dedicate full bandwidth to it, maybe even look at how you converge it back into the storage system. For other applications, take a look at it. It really comes back down to, Steve, is gaining insight, gaining knowledge, looking at your applications, and not just throwing rules of thumb at things. Look at it a little bit. Engineer it. That's the whole idea, the notion behind an engineered network is determine how you can balance things out. It's a balancing act between the very high performance, those that need guaranteed performance, low latency, cannot tolerate any congestion, versus those that can coexist. In other words, like in a typical LAN-type environment. Leverage basic network-type design with storage concerns about latency. Again, it's not all about bandwidth. It's about latency, I/O operations as well.
When should someone use a SAN versus a NAS or an iSCSI implementation?
Okay. Let's roll it up this way. When should somebody run block versus file? Okay. If somebody should run block, that would be fiber channel FICON for the mainframe, fiber channel FCP for the open systems, iSCSI for block over the network, versus NAS, file, NFS, SIFS sort of activity. Block versus file is, you want block for low latency, high performance type applications, but probably more so for applications that require block. For example, some applications can run on NAS, but they may perform better either under different workloads, performance requirements, or vendor recommendations to run on block. Some that are historically associated with having or needing to be on block have been databases, Exchange, applications like that. Now, there are caveats. You can run these different applications in different modes if you follow the vendor's recommendations, suggestions, requirements. Microsoft, for example, has had some, I'd call them mixed messaging double standards. In other words, some of their technologies, some of their applications can run on NAS as long as it's a Microsoft-based file system. Okay? That puts vendors like EMC with their Solera or NetApp or BlueArc, OnStore, you go right on down the list of the different NAS vendors, unless they are running a Windows storage server-based implementation, it puts them at a disadvantage. So consequently, it feels like a more of a double standard or marketing ploy sort of approach. But having said that, is there are conditions, and that's where you need to look at the vendor's requirements. Okay. So what many people do is they'll just run Exchange, they'll run their Oracles, unblock or heed the vendor's tips, guidelines, best practices, things like that. The case on when do you want to run NAS? Real simple. When you need to share data. If you need to not only share the storage, in other words, Steve, you're going to save your files, I'm going to save my files on the same volume, and we want to do that over the network, well, that says use NAS, unless we're going to put some other sort of data sharing software on some server, that says we're going to use NAS. If we're going to share the same file, we both want to be able to read and open the same file, maybe even write to it at different times, that says NAS, because we need some sort of software to coordinate and maintain that data coherency. That's your NAS, NFS or SIFS. So it comes down to how are you going to use the storage? When are you going to, how are you going to access the storage? How are you going to access the data? What are your application requirements? What are your performance capabilities? How do you want to manage the data?
These have been some terrific insights and some great observations, and it all brings us down to one final question, and that is, what are some best practices when it comes to designing and managing a SAN?
Yeah, so best practices, whether you're designing a SAN, whether you're designing a NAS, even for that matter, if you're just designing a resilient storage infrastructure that is shared storage using SAS or some other medium, real simple. Design for growth, design for maintenance, which means plan that you are going to have to do some maintenance at some point in time, whether it's applying new software, firmware revisions, whether it's upgrading hardware, whether it's replacing technology, whether it's adding additional capacity, whether it's more storage capacity, more switch ports, more functionality. Plan for growth, plan for maintenance, plan for diagnostics. In other words, how are you going to be able to gain insight into your storage network? What's normal? What's abnormal? How do you know if you've got a performance problem or not? How do you know if that performance problem isn't an availability? So that says design for availability, design for resiliency. Design with the idea that you're going to grow. Design for day-to-day maintenance to make it easy. Remove complexity. If you remove complexity, you can take some cost out of the equation. Design for scale. Again, you keep hearing that reoccurring theme, design for growth. Plan for the future. Implement sound and practical naming conventions. How you name your switch ports, how you name your storage devices. Implement applicable security and defenses to match those applicable threats for your environment. That means business continuance, disaster recovery, basic security, but also implement good change control, change management. If we look at where most outages, most disruptions come from, it's human error, followed by technology failure, followed by various other acts. Okay, so there's a lot of emphasis around disaster recovery, disaster planning, things like that. Yet most incidents, most problems are usually tied to a configuration error, a piece of technology failing, or somebody going out and accidentally deleting a file, or a file gets corrupted, or a file gets infected, something like that. So keep those things in mind as you're doing your design. Implement segmentation. Isolate network traffic. Keep local traffic local as opposed to flowing all over your network. While you can build very, very large storage networks, keep them logically simple, somewhat logically isolated, because, again, you have to manage it. And that ties into that theme of maintenance. If you have to do maintenance, you need to take a large network down versus a segment versus a portion of it. The other notion is to leverage tiered access as part of tiered storage and tiered protection, Steve.
Great. Well, Greg, I think that wraps it up for today's question and answer session. And I want to thank our SAN technology expert and frequent search storage contributor, Greg Schultz, for sharing his insights and expertise with us today. Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
Steve, it's my pleasure. It's been a fun experience, and I look forward to future discussions.
Great. And I'm Steve Bigelow, features writer for TechTarget Storage Media Group, and you can learn more about storage and SAN technology at www.searchstorage.com.